Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at how often you should have your pet vaccinated for rabies today, among other things. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk back with us, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. We'll talk rabies. We've got our breed of the month. And, of course, we'll be answering your pet health questions as well. So I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, email us at ideas@wpr.org, or post a question. And well, if you got a pet photo, we'd love to see that as well on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. And Dr. Sandy, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Let's start right out with a Facebook question from Ellie. She wrote to say that she tries not to cover or to over-vaccinate her dog and cats. They're all adults with positive titers. She vaccinates her dog for rabies every 3 years, but her vet insists he needs to annually revaccinate her cats because there's no longer an option for a multi-year rabies vaccine for cats. She wants to know, is this true? She's already left a practice that insisted on annual vaccinations, regardless of species or age. She doesn't want to go to a new practice, but feels annual rabies is just a way to increase revenue.
Well, I have to agree with the person that wrote this on Facebook because her veterinarian is incorrect with the information that they're providing her. When we look at rabies vaccines, there are two classifications of rabies vaccines on the market. There's one group that's called killed vaccines, where they take the virus and inactivate it so that it, and to get the immune system to be able to mount a response to it once it's given, they have to put things in there called adjuvants, which are irritating materials that pull the immune cells in so that that you can, your body mounts a good immune response to it. And that for years is all we've had available. And it comes in a 1 year and a 3 year version. And basically those are both the same vaccines. It's just the label that's different to meet local ordinance requirements, because there's some communities that still require annual rabies vaccinations. So depending on where you live, The veterinarian may be correct that you have to vaccinate every year because that's the law in our local community. There's a really good website that's called rabiesaware.org that has everything you want to know about rabies vaccine and the laws for different parts of the country in case you're traveling or moving, what you need to know for your pet. But when we started back, probably about 20 plus years ago, started recognizing that some cats would, at the site where the rabies vaccine was given, can develop a tumor called a fibrosarcoma. It's a very low odds. It's like 1 to 5 in 10,000 inoculates. But if that was in the human vaccine world to say, hey, you know, we're going to protect you from a disease, but you may get a malignant tumor that would require your leg to be amputated, I don't think it would go very far. So back probably about 20, not quite 20 years ago, they came out with something called a recombinant rabies vaccine. Very different form of vaccinating. It's only available for cats. And initially, it was only available as a one-year vaccine. This vaccine's very safe for use in cats. It's non-irritating, but it does make them feel a little dumpy for a day or two. In the recent past, I can't remember how many years it's been now, probably 3 or 4, we have now got a 3-year recombinant vaccine available for cats as well. The downside with that is it is a more expensive vaccine because unlike the killed vaccine, where the 1 year and the 3 year are the same except for the label, these are very different. One is much more potent, and so the 3 year tends to cause, in some cats, they can be even a little dumpier for the next 24 to 48 hours. So it's one of those things that is available. So I sit down with every cat owner that is needing rabies vaccination and say, here's your options. You can stay with the inexpensive killed vaccine, or you could go with the cat-only vaccine, and there's even one that's a 3-year vaccine. And sometimes it's based, decisions that owners make are based on safety. Sometimes it's based on cost. There's all kinds of things going into it, and it's my job as a veterinarian to provide the owner with all the options. And I just have to think that maybe this veterinarian just doesn't want to carry the 3-year vaccine because it is definitely more expensive. It's about three times or more the cost of the one-year vaccine.
Okay, there we go. Well, Jim in Rice Lake has something relating to vaccination, so let's just go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I have a simple question. 13 years ago, we adopted a little cat out of the shelter. We took it to a vet. We had it vaccinated. We brought it home. We put it in the house. It's never been outside since, and it's never been exposed to anything that could give it illness. We haven't had it to the vet, and we haven't vaccinated it, but it doesn't go anywhere, and it's not exposed to other animals or other conditions. Is it wrong of us not to bring it back to the vet again and have it vaccinated?
Well, this is kind of a legal situation if we're talking about rabies. It's really interesting. Our state law does not include cats in the rabies ordinance. It's just dogs in the state law. But local ordinance, it really depends on where you live, does include cats. So here in Dane County, cats are required to be vaccinated. Well, it says cats are required to wear a rabies tag. It doesn't say cats are required to be vaccinated, but I just looked at the local regulations for the city of Madison, and they're like, yeah, they have to have a rabies tag. So I guess that means to get a tag, they have to be vaccinated. The problem would be if your cat were to bite or scratch someone, you need to show current proof of rabies vaccination. If you're unable to do that, then the cat has to undergo quarantine. So now, because your cat is overdue for rabies vaccination by many, many years, it will need to be quarantined probably in a facility like a vet clinic where it's going to be put at risk of being exposed to other things that other cats are there. So, and plus your cat is 13 years of age. And at this point in your cat's life, and again, just visiting a veterinarian to have a good physical exam done to make sure that your cat is a normal weight, doesn't have heart disease, doesn't have any dental problems or other issues. A 13-year-old cat, many of them are starting to develop early kidney disease, hyperthyroidism, and those are all very treatable or controllable things that we can give cats good, long qualities of life. So regardless of whether you have your cat vaccinated or not, get them into the clinic. 13 years is a long time to wait for that really important annual physical exam.
Back to rabies shots for a minute. Someone was wondering about puppies and when do you get their first shot?
For rabies?
Yeah.
The law is it has to be done by the time they're 5 months of age. Rabies vaccine that we use for dogs, the killed vaccine, is labeled for 12 weeks and up. And so we can't give it until they're 12 weeks of age. And we have to get it in by the time they're 5 months of age. So we've got this 2-month window to have them legally vaccinated. And sometimes when we give it depends on the risk factors that the dog may be in. If it's a rural dog or out hunting, we may want to do it earlier. If it's a little itty bitty tiny dog, we may want to space the vaccines out so that we're giving the rabies as a separate vaccine, not when they're getting some of the other viral inoculations that we need to vaccinate dogs for, such as distemper and parvovirus and leptospirosis and so on. So sometimes we'll wait a little bit, but we have to get it in by 5 months of age.
And then it's every 3 years after?
And then we do it a year later.
A year later.
And then every 3 years after that. So,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. We have Jeremy in Waupun up next with a question. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a 6-year-old Labradoodle, and I just got a new puppy. He's been at the house for 2 weeks. But the Labradoodle doesn't seem to be accepting him. He just barks at him when he comes close and walks away. I was wondering, how do you introduce or get them to get along so that it makes it pleasant for everybody?
Well, before I get into how to do it, tell me a little bit about your Labradoodle. Was he dog friendly? Did he have dog friends at before you introduced this puppy? How social was he? Yeah.
He loves bigger dogs.
Okay.
He's a little bit more skittish around smaller dogs.
Okay. And what is this new dog that you have?
Well, he's an Australian Shepherd, Italian Mastiff mix, so he will...
Ooh.
Get,
He will get pretty big.
Yes. Okay. Okay. But right now he's a puppy. And I think, you know, a couple of things to do is I always have people have dogs get introduced on neutral turf. So like, you know, in a neighbor's yard or, you know, out in your front yard or something, if your dog doesn't spend a lot of time there, so that they can get to know each other where there isn't anything threatening around. Like, is this puppy going to steal my favorite toy or eat from my food bowl or something like that? I think it's really important for you to make all interactions with the puppy a pleasant experience. If you, you know, raise your voice, if he barks at the puppy and say, you know, stop it, don't do that, now he's going to start thinking, having this puppy around is pretty crummy because look at all I'm doing is getting, you know, yelled at or isolated and the puppy's getting all the attention. So I think that, you know, making all interactions really pleasant, whether it's, you know, if your dog is not, you know, like toy aggressive, then, you know, playing with toys with your adult dog while the puppy is playing with somebody else with a toy, you know, maybe having them both be getting treats in the same vicinity, but not near each other. So again, presence of puppy equals, oh, I'm having fun now. And eventually things will get better. I just went through this a year ago and I thought, oh my goodness, I went online with a rescue group to adopt an adult dog and they ended up sending me a puppy with a lot of problems. And I had the growling, snapping, turning their back, nose out of joint, you know, and within a couple of weeks, things really turned around when I started taking my own advice and putting Pete, the young adult, first and giving greeting him first, paying attention to him first, letting him know that he is still the top dog in the household. And things really turned around very, very quickly
from there. Mm-hmm. All right. Good luck, Jeremy. Thank you for calling. We have Connie online from Portage next. Hi, Connie.
Hi, good morning. I hate to bug you. I talked to you not too long ago, Dr. Sajak, about my corgi who's diabetic now.
Mm-hmm.
And come to find out, my vet was a student of yours. And I told him I called you. And he did the curve. He's done everything right.
Okay.
But now it's been a week or two, and nothing else has been done. And what I'm curious about now is, what's the next step or what do I worry about?
Well, when we are doing a glucose curve, the reason why we do that is that every dog responds to the dose of insulin that we're giving to them differently. And so this way we're able to see just how high the blood sugar is before the insulin is given, how low it goes when it's like kind of midway through the day, and then watching it, you know, spring back up again. So we kind of have an idea of the highs and lows. And so we use that to adjust our insulin dose, either up or down, depending on where we're at. Sometimes we will see dogs that seem to be out of control, just becoming non-insulin responsive, where, you know, hey, I've been giving their insulin and they've been doing fine, and then all of a sudden they're drinking more and urinating more, and you do a curve and you find out that, you know, you're not getting a good response. Then we start looking for underlying causes that may cause insulin resistance, things like infections, bladder infections, dental disease. Those types of things can really throw off the dog's ability to be regulated with their diabetes. So if you're having a hard time, you know, getting your dog regulated, then that would be something to be looking for, is some underlying infection that could be triggering this insulin resistance, if that's what's going on. But yeah, it's time to go back to your veterinarian and say, okay, you've got the results. What do we do with them now? And if you haven't gotten a phone call from them, well, it's time for you to get on the phone and say, I need help. You know, what's the results? Do I go up in insulin? When do I recheck again? It's one of these very hands-on cases that veterinarians are having to deal with more and more often because of the level of obesity in our pets. We're seeing so many pets with diabetes these days.
There you go, Connie. Thank you so much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn and her guest take a look at the science behind spelling, why some of us are really good at it, and some, like me, just aren't so good at it. And we'll talk about that at 2 o'clock today. Right now, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, taking a look at your pet's health, your dog or your cat. I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Got a pet photo. We'd love to see that on our Facebook page. You can also post a question there. The Larry Mueller Show, that's the title of our page. And email at ideas@wpr.org. Let's turn to Jan in Appleton next. Jan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I just love your show, and I love Sandy being on it, too.
Oh, thank you.
I took in a stray cat last fall, and so it's used to being outside, and it likes to be inside also. And now that it's getting nice out, I'm worried about fleas.
Mm-hmm.
I purchased a flea collar, but it even says not to touch it, you know, when you're opening it. Mm-hmm. And I hate having it on the pet, and I don't even like touching it. So I'm wondering if there's anything else you can use.
Yeah, there are a lot of different products that are available, and I always recommend going to your veterinarian to find the right thing for your cat. There are many, many over-the-counter products that are really not that safe, but have been kind of grandfathered in because they've been on the market for so many years. And that may be the type of flea collar that you actually picked up. If you want to stay with a collar for flea and tick control, remember cats can get ticks. And although they're fairly resistant to Lyme disease, we do know that they can get anaplasma, and they can also get a disease called cytozoonosis that the Lone Star tick that is now in our state is carrying. So there are some tick-borne diseases that cats are at risk at as well. The collar that I really like is one by the Bear Company, and it's called the Seresto collar, S-E-R-E-S-T-O. It lasts for 8 months. And it's very, very safe because it works by friction. And so it doesn't, the chemical isn't going to just, you know, come off all at once or when you're handling it. It's safe for use around children and so on. And even for dogs, they make them for dogs as well, for dogs that are swimming. Even in the water, it doesn't leach the chemical out of the collar. So it's a nice one to consider using. And you may want to talk to your veterinarian about using that, although I do believe that they are available over the counter. There are several topical products that you could use as well. You have to be really careful, though, because the dog products that are out there that contain some of the classes of chemicals, mainly the permethrin-type chemicals, very, very toxic for cats. And so don't use a dog product on the cat. Make sure you know your cat's weight before you apply anything. And use one of the ones. This is where you get what you pay for when it comes to some of the spot-on products. So things like Frontline or Advantage are very good, although Advantage only gets fleas and doesn't get ticks. Frontline will get fleas and ticks. And there's several other kind of generic fipronil or Frontline-like products that are out there now too for cats. So this would be something to discuss with your veterinarian. But I think finding a different collar, if that's the way you want to go, is your sure. in your best interest and the cat's.
Sure thing. Thanks, Jan. Appreciate the call. Richard in Westcott emailed to say he recently heard that NexGard can cause scratching and itching symptoms. Have you noticed this as a problem, Dr. Sandy? And is it, if it is, what tick treatment is better?
Wow. You know, I have not seen any reactions at all with any of the topical or the oral products. NexGard happens to be one of three of the long-lasting oral products. There's some other oral products on the market that only last for about 24 hours. So we use those when we have a pet come into the hospital that has fleas and we don't want to hospitalize it till they're gone. If you want NexGard, it lasts for a month. There's one called Bravecto that gives you 3 months of control, and then there's also one that's called Simparica that gives you a month control as well. I've seen no reactions to it at all. I would love to see his reference where he's seeing this, and I will go into adverse drug reaction reports and see if I can find anything and report back next time I'm on the air, but that would be new information for me.
All right. Rosemary in Cloverland, it's up to you now. Hi.
Hey.
What can we do for you? Oh, we lost Rosemary. Let's go to Bob in Wauwatosa. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. We have an English field cocker
about a year and a half old. She runs about 27 pounds, and her pee has destroyed our lawn, and we don't know what to do about it. I'd rather treat the lawn with something rather than give some kind of pill to the dog. Do you have any advice?
Yeah, well, welcome to my world. We are turning our backyard into a giant playground this summer with three dogs. We have virtually no grass left between the running and the playing and the peeing and killing the grass. It is it's a mess. And so we're actually going to just landscape cloth and put mulch down, and that's our backyard. It's going to probably, you know, be a lot easier than trying to, you know, reseed and do things like that. But the reason why the grass is dying is because urine is really high in ammonia, and it contains nitrogen, and so it's basically being over-fertilized and burned. There are over-the-counter products. There's one called, I think it's called Greenums, that's supposed to change the pH of the urine or do something. But I always worry about giving dogs something like that, because if they are bladder stone formers, by messing with their urine pH, that could predispose them to getting some bladder stones. So your only other option would be to target train her to a more suitable spot where you start training her to, like, if she urinates, like, in an area maybe where you've got some mulch down or just an area of your yard that you don't care if the grass is dead. If she hits the jackpot and goes over there, she gets a boatload of treats and is like, hey, you're really happy. Other places, it's just like, yeah, good girl, you went outside. So you can start target training them to a specific area by just reinforcing when they go in that spot that that's the best spot to go. You could hose down, to have a watering can or a hose ready to hose down the lawn in the area where she's gone, just to dilute out the urine. Other than that, I really don't have any other suggestions. And I think the next time you're doing like a garden show or something with somebody that does sod work, ask them, because I want to know how to do it. Yeah.
The two tips you gave, finding a corner of the lawn and also the water can or the hose, are the two that I've always heard.
Yes. Okay, good.
If someone else will call and say, oh, I give my dog tomato juice.
Yes, yeah. And what is that? Acidifying the urine and changing the pH or whatever, but it's still, you're dealing with nitrogen. It's just a natural part of protein digestion that the kidneys are dealing with.
So there you go, Bob. Thank you so much for calling. Norman in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Norman.
Good morning. I'm wondering if your good vet there, Sandy, can tell me why and what we can do about our 3-year-old golden retriever urinating when it comes up to somebody, usually a stranger.
Yeah, and you know,
do it when they go up to it or anything.
Yeah, they dogs will do that for two reasons. One, just excitement. My dog Pete, whenever he sees his former owner, pees on him. Okay, and he gets so excited. It's like, oh my God, Mike's here, and I'm, you know, and yet he doesn't do it for anybody else but just Mike. So Mike has to know, greet him outside, and it's just the way he is. The other thing would be is that if they are submissive urinators, and sometimes when people are coming up, if you've got a dog that's a little shy or, you know, just, you know, not really confident, they may let a little bit of urine go. And so what I do in cases like that is, number one, no punishment. It's totally involuntary. Number two, you know, instruct the people that are approaching the dog to don't look at the dog, don't reach for the dog, maybe present their side, maybe squat down to be on the dog's level so that they are not leaning over the dog to pet it or greet it, which can be perceived as very threatening. Maybe carry some like dog treats in your pocket that you can toss to the person, where they can toss treats to the dog, where the, you know, and again, you're just changing the perception of, this is a stranger who I need to be a little wary of or shy up with, to, wow, I love new people coming up to me because they don't lean over, they don't reach for me, and they toss treats my way. And hopefully with doing that enough, it will stop. But it's one of those chronic things. That's why we always have a mop at the vet clinic, because we deal with it all the time.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling, Norman. Barbara in Green Bay, we're on to you now. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to talk to the doctor a little bit about this cat that I have. She's a year old now. She was dumped off as a tiny bitty kitty at 8 weeks. And my vet calls her an alpha cat, and she also says that she must be half feral. So you get kind of the idea of what her personality is.
Okay.
Now, at home, I love her. And I have two Cavaliers, and she wants to play with them all the time. She's very good. Now, when she was tinier, she bit a lot, and we conquered that. And my philosophy with her is to just kind of let her do whatever she wants, unless she's really doing something she shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then I try not to yell at her because she doesn't like that, but I use the squirt bottle, which is fine.
Okay.
So at home, we love her. However, when I take her to the vet, it is a horrible scene.
Oh, and that is why in the veterinary world, almost any meeting that vets go to now or journal that you pick up, you will be seeing things about fear-free practice. And what this initiative is to help cats like this that are, and although she may be your veterinarian saying she's like a controlling cat, my guess is that she is just so scared that she becomes defensive. And there's a number of things that we can do. Number one would be, making sure that getting in the carrier is the first step, and that the cat knows that the carrier is a safe spot. So well before you're going to take your kitty in to be examined, have that carrier out and be part of the furnishings in your house. You may have to dismantle it.
Yeah, we do that.
Good. So she goes in and out,
yep,
and takes treats,
yep,
pick
yep
it up, carry it
yep
around the house, put it down where it's no, yep, no longer this evil thing. Talk to your veterinarian about pre-medding your kitty with a drug that's just going to make them a little more comfortable with going into the clinic. And the drug that we typically are using now is one that people use for neuropathic pain. Why it works this way in cats, I don't know, but it works very well at calming these cats down. And the drug is called gabapentin. And we'll give a cat a couple hours or an hour before their appointment a tablet of gabapentin, and they will often be much easier to work with. We do a lot of our exams on cats that are scared or fractious under a towel. We'll dismantle the carrier in the exam room. We'll slide a towel over them and do our examination just in bits and pieces where just maybe a hind leg is exposed. We slide our stethoscope underneath and, work with them that way so that, we're not letting them get ramped up. If we see that, if we have a cat that comes in with no drugs on board, and they are getting so ramped up that we can't get anything done, we send them home because it's useless to keep going because that's just going to make things worse. So we'll say, you know what, take a couple of weeks, and unless the cat's ill, but if it's a wellness appointment or something that can wait, take your cat home. Here's some medication. We want you to pre-med your cat. Then come back in, and we're going to try this again. But we're going to have the lights dim. We're going to have you in an area where there aren't any dogs, preferably a cat-only exam room with feel-away plugged in. We're going to be talking softly. We're going to open all our syringes and everything up outside the room so they don't hear that tearing paper, which sounds like hissing. We're going to do all these things to try to make it as calm and as peaceful as we can. I always put in the back of my mind what it's like to go to like a masseuse that has incense burning and, the soft music and the warm blankets. And, it sets that mood for I'm relaxing. That's what we're trying to do for our cats as well.
There we go. Thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it. Rosemary in Cloverland, it is your turn now. Hi, Rosemary.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Sajak. I have a question. My sister has a dog. Her name is Brownie, and she's 10 years old. She's a mixed pit and Labrador.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, her vet scared her and said that this is cancer. And they went through the whole thing of giving her a biopsy and everything, and as it turns out, it was some kind of a fatty tissue or something mm-hmm in there. And now she's got another one.
Mm-hmm.
They look like little tumors, and it's getting a little bit bigger, and the doctor doesn't want to touch her now because after what they did, they all thought that she had cancer, and it turns out that she didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, are these common in these dogs? She's very well fit. My sister takes the best of care for her. She's got her own couch, her own TV, her own.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, lipomas. If that's what this was, are very, very common in dogs, and they're even common in people. A lot of humans get them as well, mm-hmm. and they're just a benign. Like when you surgically remove them, we end up, they look like a little ball of fat, very little blood supply, and it's just fat, and it's not fat that is going to be affected by metabolism. So if you took the dog and put them on a reduced calorie diet to lose weight, they wouldn't be affected. They're just going to sit there, and you may even notice them more because now they're sticking out like a sore thumb because the dog's slender, and with the short hair being a pit lab mix, you're going to see them more. I always recommend, though, making sure that you confirm what it is, because there are other look-alike tumors, and just because a dog has one or two lipomas doesn't mean that that third one that pops up is going to be a benign fatty growth. We had a dog in the other day, multiple lipomas, new mass. It felt a little bit harder, but it was still like, okay, maybe it's just a fatty tumor under a muscle. Turned out to be a soft tissue sarcoma, which is going to be a much more life-threatening type mass. We had another dog in, 13 new little tumors that was on the dog, and we do what's called body mapping, where we sit down with a pair of calipers, and it's very time-consuming. That's where I keep my students busy. I'm like, find every tumor on this dog, measure it, map it on this, map of all these positions that the dogs can be in, and then we're going to put a little needles in and determine what they are. Lucky number 13 on this dog, which unlucky, turned out to be a mast cell tumor, and I thought it was going to be a lipoma. I'm just like, I'm going through the motions, and I am so glad I jumped through that hoop because I probably saved that dog's life. Mm. So, I'm not saying that the new one is a fatty tumor, but the veterinarian should find out what it is. And it's so simple to do a needle biopsy.
Okay, because he just said just keep an eye on it if it gets any bigger. And she's just afraid, well, if it gets any bigger, it might be too late.
Right. And that's why it needs to be looked at. Any new masses, find out what they are. Then you can say, okay, I can just watch it. Lipomas will change in size. I mean, some of them, they kind of have this predetermined size that they're going to be. Some stay small, some get to be quite large and can be cumbersome for the dog. To give you an example, we had a dog in, this was a year or two ago, large lipoma just in his caudal abdomen, lateral to his penis, okay, just next to his penis. And it got so big, it was the size of a grapefruit, it was pushing his penis to one side, and every time he would urinate, he would pee on his front leg. Because everything was off kilter. And so removing it made the dog more comfortable. We've had a dog in not too long ago that was a seeing eye dog that had one underneath his harness. And it was big enough that it was rubbing and it was bothering the dog. So we removed that one. Sometimes they're in the armpit and it may impede movement if it would be like having an orange in your armpit. You can imagine how that would feel. So sometimes we do have to remove them. But for the most part, they're cosmetic and we just watch them.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling, Rosemary. Robert in Ashland, you are next. Hi, Robert.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a 10-year-old pit bull, American Bulldog mix. Blew out its ACL, its knee, about 9 months ago. And vet said there's nothing you can do about it, and she is on a pain pill every day, 100 milligrams.
Carprofen, yeah.
Carprofen, and then she also takes old PC formula, glucosamine, is that a good thing to give her?
Yeah, glucosamine. You have to be careful with over-the-counter supplements because not all of them are created equal. They're very poorly regulated, and so you may get, not as much active ingredient in some products as you would in another. I have to disagree with your vet, though, that when they said there was nothing that could be done, there is surgical intervention is something that can be done. Perhaps that wasn't something that you wanted to pursue, but...
Well, they said with her age, she probably wouldn't stand the anesthesia.
Well, 10 years old is a that's not that old. And I don't look at age as a disease. And so I think that it all depends on how healthy your dog is. If their blood values are normal and heart is normal and the rest of them are doing fine, the other leg is fine so they can get around postoperatively, then by all means, I mean, to have your dog say, you know, if she lives to be 12 to 14, you know, to say you're going to be living, a, you know, 25 to 30% of your life in chronic pain, that just isn't fair to your dog. So, yeah.
How often do you think they should get her blood tested to make sure her organs aren't getting screwed up from the pain pills?
Yeah, and that's a really good thing to do, too, because this medication can affect the liver and can affect the kidneys. And as dogs get older, they're more predisposed to having organ malfunctions. And so typically, a senior dog that is on this type of medication, if, you know, we check initially before we put them on it, usually after they've been on it for 2 or 3 weeks to see if they're one of these really hypersensitive dogs, then usually every 6 months after that.
There we go.
Every six months. One more question, if I may.
All right.
Every time in March, about this time of year, just once a year, I live in a boathouse right on Swamigan Bay, Lake Superior here, and beach house, just 12 by 24, and she's dog aggressive, so she's never been spayed, and she never could be with another animal. We're just real isolated, me and her. And she starts nesting, digging up the couch, the beds, everything. Because I got foxes, weasels, minks, and rabbits that mate under here. Is that why she's doing that?
No, my guess is that she's probably one of these dogs. Most dogs come into heat twice a year. She may be one that only comes into heat once a year, and it's in the springtime. And many, many dogs will go through something called a false pregnancy, where hormonally their body thinks they're pregnant. And so they often will lactate and even like do things like nesting and so on. So you can see it, you know, from the behavior's point of view, the nesting right up to, boy, they're even producing milk for imaginary puppies. So that's probably what's going on. I doubt it has anything to do with the wildlife in the area. But it does sound like you're in a very pretty part of the
state.
Yeah,
it sure does.
Wonderful. What, and she's I'm sorry. She's she does excessive licking on her. She's got real big, even though she's never had puppies, never been spayed, but excessive licking on her back too. They're almost like udders are huge.
Yeah, and she probably again is lactating, and that's probably what's causing that. So yeah,
there you go.
Yeah. Oh,
Robert, thank you so much for for calling. Excuse me. Appreciate your call very much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for listening in. You can call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post a pet photo and question on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Jenny in Milwaukee up next. Hi, Jenny. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a long-haired cat that we rescued from the outdoors as a kitten, and he's about a year and a half old, and he can't keep up with his coat, and he's got knots all over his belly, and I try to brush him all the time. I try to cut them out, but he's getting problems. On his backside, like carrying things from his litter.
Oh, yes. Okay.
So I'm wondering, I called the vet and they will shave him for me, but they said if he gets unruly, they'd have to put him under and then I'd have to pay for anesthesia. And I'm wondering if there's any sort of DIY thing I can do besides what I'm already doing.
Yeah.
Like, the cat myself.
Yeah. Well, learning how to use clippers is something that takes some time because cats have really elastic skin. And depending on the size of the clipper blades that you're using, you know, you've got everything from the surgical blades, which are going to just shave him bald. And the number on the blade, the bigger it is, the shorter the hair. So when we're shaving for surgery, we're using a number 40 blade. When you're shaving for looks, we're typically using a 10 blade on a cat to get under those mats. And I have to, I know, I used to do grooming back before I even got into vet school, and it was one of my like summer job type things. And they would always hand the cats to me because no one wanted to do them. And they, the first thing you always do is trim their nails because they often don't like the sound of the clippers. Being in that position, if he doesn't tolerate being brushed or having the mats hand clipped out, he's probably not going to tolerate clippers really well. So, yes, you can try it, but be really careful that you don't get some of that stretchy skin caught in those clipper blades and tear the skin. That can happen. I've seen it happen even in a veterinary clinic when you've got, you know, a kitty with lots of mats and thick hair coat. So it's, you know, there are some risks involved, but I would say initially, you know, you try going to just a professional groomer. They are not in the position to be able to anesthetize or sedate your cat. Mm-hmm. And they you know, probably are very skilled at being able to do this thing, to do the lion cut on these cats. So
thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'd give that a try. And in Milwaukee, you're going to find groomers.
Lots of groomers. But some of them may not do cats. So it's worthwhile making some phone calls. Yeah.
Thank you so much for calling, Jenny. And we had an email from Susan to say her 14-month-old dog has lost some of her puppy teeth. She has consulted two different vets, and one says they should come out. The other says no. Who's right? Her dog also has a patellar locution.
Luxation.
Luxation,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It pops back most of the time, but not always. This happens daily. When should she consider surgery?
Well, I'm going to just make a wild guess here that this is a little miniature breed dog, either a toy poodle, a Yorkie, you know, something like that, because those are the dogs that we're going to see a lot of these problems in. Retained deciduous teeth or baby teeth that don't fall out are a problem for the dog. So I agree with vet number one that says take them out. The dog's mouth is crowded already because they're small. And when you have two teeth in the space that one tooth belongs, now you're going to have an area where you're going to get pretty early severe periodontal disease because the teeth are just so crammed in there. So they do need to come out. This is one of the reasons why when I'm doing like spays and neuters of these little dogs, I will, even though I don't do surgery anymore, I will have the owners of these dogs just swing by for a no charge off call. I just say, I just want to have a peek in the mouth. If the teeth are still present, then I can set up an appointment with so they can be spayed and neutered and have those baby teeth taken out at the same time while the mouth is still healthy. The fact that your dog is now 14 months old, there probably is already some periodontal disease going on. So get those taken care of ASAP. The knees, boy, without having a feel myself, I'm hard-pressed to say how bad your dog is. We grade patellar luxations on a scale of 1 to 4, where I would guess that if your dog has kneecaps that are staying out some of the time, but you can get them in, that would be considered a grade 3 patellar luxation, and your dog would probably be considered a surgical candidate sooner rather than later. Because the longer you wait, you're going to end up having cartilage damage, ligament damage, and arthritis setting in because that kneecap is slipping back and forth all the time.
Nancy and Madison, we are on to you now. Hi, Nancy. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question regarding vaccines, if we could go back to that.
Sure.
Sure.
Could you explain, like, the scientific, medical, you know, in the veterinary field, reason for, like, 1 year and 3 year that has been decided that that's appropriate? I know states, you said regulations in your various areas, but what does the medical field say about what we really need for vaccines?
Well, I'm going to give you my human problem. I am allergic to rabies vaccine. I was last vaccinated in 1983, and I'm aging myself here. Okay, but I just get my titer or my immune status checked every couple of years, and I am still protected. So how do we come up with a 3-year expiration date for rabies vaccine? when they're doing, because rabies is a human health risk, the testing is very specific. They have to have a group of control animals, dogs or cats, and a group of animals that are vaccinated. And then they expose them to really real rabies. I know it sounds horrible, but you have to have so many of them live or die, and, you know, it, to be able to pass the vaccine. So they, you know, if it's going to be labeled for, like, let's just say the 1 year rabies vaccine that they have out for cats, when they have attempted to test that and see, does it provide longer protection for 3 years? They didn't have enough of the controls die, so they didn't use a strong enough strain of rabies, I guess, or something was going on.
Yeah.
And so FDA didn't pass it and said you have to go back and only do it for 1 year because your three-year attempt failed. So they went back to the drawing board and came out with a brand new vaccine that they were able to then get a three-year label on. Does that mean that at 3 years, click, it's off and it doesn't work anymore? Obviously not. We know that it provides much longer protection, but it's just who's going to pay to have all these animals housed in isolation and wait until they're 6, 7, 8 years of age? I don't know of any company that's going to do that. And so there is a study right now going on at the veterinary school, and it's going to take a long time to see how long do pets keep their immune status from rabies vaccine. And I would bet that we're going to start seeing in the future vaccines having longer expiration dates, where we may say you can do it every 5 years. You know, it's gathering information like that, where there isn't research funding, is, you know, and it's not going to be sponsored by a company that's making money. So as veterinarians, our hands are tied, and we have to follow the law.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the explanation.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Thank you. Mike in Verona, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I have a 4-year-old golden retriever mix, and about maybe a month and a half ago, found a lump on his leg and took him into the vet to get it checked out, and it turned out it was just an abscess that needed to be drained, but given the size of it, it was about a golf ball size.
Mm-hmm.
She thought she may have to do some general anesthesia, so she gave him the whatever the cocktail is before they give general anesthesia, uh-huh, to relax. And that apparently was enough. And when they finished up the procedure, we went to take him out, and he basically lost his legs out from under him, kind of collapsed. So she wanted to just keep an eye on him and kept him in there for a couple hours. And ultimately, just from this kind of pre-cocktail, he was basically out of it, wobbly on his feet, not himself, you know, for probably 2-3 days.
Wow.
And so she was real concerned about his liver function,
mm-hmm,
and wanted me to bring him back in. And we did some liver tests, and his liver function was the low end of normal, but she was still kind of concerned because otherwise he's very healthy and everything. And she did, she checked for, I think it was a liver shunt, was her other concern, and had that sent off to actually two different labs, and they both found nothing, totally normal function. So
yeah.
I guess the result was he just can't handle that pre-medication.
Right.
And I guess my two questions were, because he also does, he's developed in the last year or so, he gets real nervous during thunderstorms. He never had that until recently, and I think it was just around the last 4th of July that it started, and I think it was fireworks. So
okay.
He had given me a prescription for some type of anti-anxiety.
Yeah.
And I guess my two questions were, you know, she said he really just can't handle that drug. Should I be worried about other medications like that?
Oh boy. That's a really good question, and it's really hard to say because I have to sedate patients all the time, and I'm really lucky in that I have anesthesia just down the hall, and I will take, you know, all the patient history and everything and say, this is what we need to do. What would you give the dog? And even with board certified anesthesiologists figuring out doses and doing things, we still keep records so that we can say, good sedation, not enough. You know, the dog became a little, you know, too euphoric on it, or prolonged recovery, so that we know how to adjust and what to avoid using down the road. For the most part, when we are using medications for anxiety, we're using different classes of drugs. One that we'll often use that's similar to what is given for sedation is a product called Celio. It's a new one that's out that's dexdomitor in an oral gel, but it's at a much different dose than what we're given by injection. So even if that was the drug that was in the cocktail, that may still be a very safe alternative for your dog for noise phobias. Often we'll use things like Valium or Xanax. So those would be things, again, very dose dependent. I treated my dog once and I gave him what I thought would be an appropriate dose because he hated going in the car. And when he got out at a rest stop, he fell over. And so I went, okay, we got a little too much going into you. Even though most of my patients would have been able to tolerate that and not have any trouble, he couldn't. So I ended up cutting his dose in half, and he was fine after that. So it's very dog-dependent, dose-dependent, drug-dependent, and I'm sorry I can't answer your question, but I think your dog does need some help with the noise phobia. It's just going to get worse.
There we go.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks for calling. Jim and Madison, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a cat that's probably about 12 years old, and she went about 4 years ago, went under an operation for, I believe, a bladder stone, and there was a problem with anesthesia with that operation. I think there's a problem with the oxygen control, and she may have had too much oxygen in her brain, but she almost died, came back with some brain damage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she's pretty much blind. She's got a little bit of vision, but my main question right now is the last year and a half. So, I mean, she's getting along around the house pretty good. She remembers where she is. But my problem now, about a year or a year and a half, she's been having seizures about once a month or every 5 weeks. And because of the operation malfunction, I believe.
Yeah.
We're going to have to take Sandy's answer after we take a look at the news, and then we'll be back with Dr. Sandy. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look, excuse me, at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Join in, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. And if you've got a photo of your pet, we'd love to hear to see that as well on the Facebook page. Sandy, the Jim and Madison called a cat with seizures, and there's a vet school study.
There is a vet school study, and there's lots of different studies going on at the veterinary school, and I encourage anybody that has a pet that they would be interested in partaking in any of these studies to contact us. But if you go to the website, uwveterinarycare.edu, the studies are listed on that right on the startup page. You can find them there. And there is one that is specific for cats that are epileptic. So it might be worthwhile if he's not that far away to be looking at coming in and visiting with one of our neurologists.
Yeah, and he's in Madison, mm-hmm. So it'd be definitely worth a look. So hope that comes to pass. We have Pet of the Month, and I'm looking on our Facebook page right now,
yeah.
And we have some really beautiful King Charles.
Yep, the Cavalier Spaniel. King Charles Spaniel. You know, they're the 19th most popular dog right now, according to AKC. And I don't know whether I see a lot of them coming into my practice, and so I think that it might be locally higher, but that's just my take on it. You know, they're considered a toy breed, even though they're not as tiny as like a Chihuahua or the little tiny Yorkies. They weigh about 13 to 18 pounds on average. And, you know, they're just lovely dogs. They're very affectionate and friendly. Probably not the best for training if you're looking for, you know, a really well-trained dog, but they're really happy to sit on your lap and give you lots of love and get along with your kids and everything. But there's always that but. if you're contemplating getting any breed of dog, which is why I wanted to bring this up, is you need to do your homework when it comes to what are you going to expect health-wise for getting a certain breed of dog. And for the Cavalier, they are unfortunately blessed with a whole host of health problems that there's a lot of different studies and things going on to try to figure out, you know, if we can come, you know, get some of these diseases down to a dull roar. The big ones that I see in my practice are these dogs coming in with heart disease. Many small breeds of dogs, once they get to be over 10, about a third of the dogs that are small breed dogs will develop mitral valve heart disease, where the valve becomes leaky. But these guys develop it much earlier.
Oh.
And what is recommended is that if you are working with a breeder, that breeder should be having their dog evaluated every year for mitral valve disease. And I would want to wait until the dog, before it's bred, is at least 2. And I want to know what the parents of that dog, you know, when did they develop heart disease? And anybody else in the dog's ancestry really know the heart status, because it's so sad to see these dogs going into heart failure at a young age. And I mean, like under 10. I mean, we're seeing them pass away. The other thing that we're seeing a lot of is based on the fact that they have been bred to have a very small skull for the size of their brain. And they develop a condition called syringomyelia and Carey malformation. And what this is they have like cystic type things in their spinal cord. And because their skull is so small, the brain starts getting pushed out the backside and everything's getting squished. And these dogs will come in scratching at their neck like crazy, shaking their head, crying out in pain. They're usually really hypersensitive, to the area in their neck. And unfortunately, there's really not a whole lot we can do. We didn't know, but, you know, years ago, we didn't even know what this was. We thought the dogs maybe had allergies or something. And it wasn't until the invention of the MRI that we realized these dogs actually have a brain disease that's causing this. And so we're typically looking at gabapentin, long-term use, or probably lifetime use with pain medication. There are some surgical things that may be able to be done, but you'd have to definitely work with a specialist on that. And the other thing that I'm seeing a lot of, too, is something that breeders are calling glue ear. Their middle ear cavity should be filled with fluid. And for some reason, this breed will get that material in their middle ear is really thick. And these dogs will come in. In fact, one of our dogs that we use as a teaching dog has a head tilt. And it's because she's got chronic middle ear disease, because the material in that middle ear is like glue. And it affects about 40% of the dogs of Cavaliers. Not all of them are clinical, but about 40% of them will have this as an issue. So there's, and that's not all. I mean, there's so many other things they get. There's a study going on right now looking at something called episodic falling syndrome. They have a fly snapping problem, which is almost like a seizure disorder. They have knee luxations that we've talked about, common in small breed dogs. They can get eye problems. And so parents, before they're used for breeding, should be checked by an ophthalmologist and screened for juvenile cataracts and retinal degeneration. So know what you're getting into before you get one of these adorable dogs. It just breaks my heart to say, guess what? Your dog has heart disease and you're going to become good friends with our cardiology department. So anyways, that's the Cavalier in a nutshell. And we'll take suggestions for other breeds if someone wants to talk about other breeds.
There we go. So if you've got an idea, please post it up on Facebook or just send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Charlotte in Mount Horeb next. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi. I was just calling with a comment. Since Easter is quickly approaching, I just wanted to implore parents to not get their small children pet rabbits for Easter. It's still something that's fairly commonly done. It'd be much more appropriate to get a child a stuffed animal rabbit or some sort of toy rabbit instead.
Mm-hmm.
I volunteer for the Humane Society and the House Rabbit Society, So I know that we still get inundated every single year.
Oh, yeah.
Following Easter, because parents have gotten small children a pet rabbit for Easter, thinking, wouldn't that be adorable?
Yeah. And, you know, rabbits do make wonderful pets. I mean, the House Rabbit Association has, I know your group has wonderful information out there on integrating a rabbit into your home. But again, any holiday is not a time to be introducing a new pet. You need to go into it with your eyes wide open so that you know that these are a species that needs to be spayed and neutered, that have special diet requirements, housing requirements. Your house needs to be rabbit-proofed. Those are all things that your wonderful organization provides that information to people. And so if they are considering getting a rabbit, not at Easter, but maybe at some other time, and it's not for the child, it's for the family. And this is for any pet. It's the whole family needs to be buying into this, because everyone is involved with the care.
Yeah, absolutely.
And as you said a moment ago regarding dogs, you said do your homework first.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, getting information about rabbit care and whether it be a good pet for your household, doing that ahead of time would help immensely.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. Because then they end up in the shelter, and it's sad to see how many get there.
Yeah. Thank you, Charlotte.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Well, let's go to Dan in Coloma next. Dan, hi to you.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have, I'm questioning oral care for my dog. He sometimes has bad breath, and I was looking at his teeth, and they seem to be a little dark. He brushed the dog's teeth with a little toothbrush, or is there a type of toothpaste that's better or for them? Or
yeah, I mean, we always recommend toothbrushing. Remember, pets, we're typically brushing not to prevent cavities, but to prevent periodontal disease. And so you can brush before you feed your dog, but rather than after, so that the feeding, the meal becomes the reward for having their teeth brushed. The toothpaste and things, unless there's a medicated need for it, is really just flavoring, and you don't have to use toothpaste. You don't want to use human toothpaste because it has fluoride and detergents and things in it, and dogs just don't appreciate that mint fresh that we do, and we spit after brushing our teeth. Dogs don't. They'll swallow it. So, but back to brushing. If your dog has pre-existing dental disease already going on, they may resent having a brush put in the mouth. And so if there's odor there, if the teeth are discolored, if there's visible tartar, the red gums, get those teeth cleaned and taken care of before you start your oral care program, so that then after they're clean, you can keep them in that state much longer. But dogs, just like people, need to go in periodically to have their oral cavity taken care of. In the human world, we go in every 6 months, and that's what's recommended. And I mean, I brush and floss, and it's amazing that they still find tartar and things on my teeth. So you can imagine a dog that's only going in every couple of years, which is not recommended, you're going to end up having some pretty significant problems. So before you introduce anything, get that mouth checked out. The other thing that can cause discolored teeth is not necessarily tartar on the teeth, but sometimes we'll see dogs that have had like trauma to their mouth, especially to their teeth, have the blood supply to the teeth disrupted, and it will cause the teeth to become kind of purpley, dark, reddish color. Some people will call it dead tooth or a devitalized tooth. Those are teeth that probably need to be removed or have a root canal done if it's necessary to be able to maintain the tooth. So, yeah, time to visit your veterinarian and get that looked into.
Okay. Good luck. Thanks, Dan, for calling. Sheila in Dubuque, Iowa, your turn. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Yes, I'm concerned about our dog gaining weight. And I worry about the amount of food we give him. And we've had him 2 years, and I think he's gained over 10 pounds.
Wow.
And our vet says he's overweight.
Okay.
So
how do you do that? Well, what we do is I actually sit down with the calculator, and we have a formula that we use that I just can't do at the top of my head because I need a calculator to be able to do the math. And we figure out what would be, number one, your dog's ideal weight. So if when you first got your dog, that when it was 10 pounds lighter, if your veterinarian said, yes, your dog is perfect weight at this weight, then that would be our goal. And we would take that ideal weight, plug it into a formula, and come up with how many calories your dog needs a day. And it's going to be it's going to be a lot less than you probably think your dog actually needs. And we divide their food up into, you know, a couple of feedings a day. We really watch any extras like rawhide or treats and things. If we are going to give the dog snacks, things like baby carrots are very good. But even then, you can overdo it because carrots have calories too. So it's a matter of then sitting down and saying, okay, how many baby carrots can you get a day? How much food can you get a day? The whole family buys into this. You use a measuring cup. You know how many calories are in the food, and you feed them an appropriate diet that is usually a low-calorie, low-fat diet. There are various prescription or therapeutic diets that are on the market that help with improving metabolism, that are higher in fiber to make the dogs feel fuller. But you can get adequate diets that are low-calorie over-the-counter as well. But without actually having your dog in front of me, the actual weight and a calculator, I really can't tell you how many calories your dog needs, but a 10-pound weight gain, if they are not growing, that's significant.
That's a lot. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Sheila. Well, we have some photos up on Facebook. Jeremy sent one. He called earlier about his puppy, him introducing the puppy to an older dog. Look at that.
Oh, my goodness. This is the one that was being introduced to a Labradoodle, and the Labradoodle didn't want to have anything to do with them. Well, you know, if you've got a cute little thing like that, I think I'd be a little upset, too, that, you know, why is he so cute?
Oh, man, he's so cute. And Doug sent one of Gus, his Packer, with his Packer toy.
There he is. He's a Packer backer. Yep. Oh, my goodness. Yep.
Nice photos. Thanks for sending them in. You can send one in, too, at the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. Janice in Renshaw, Minnesota, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. We have a toy Shih Tzu that has little black heads they're called comedones, on her back. And I was told to use a shampoo called Maliseb.
Okay.
And it doesn't, and I was supposed to do the shampoo her twice a week with this and leave it on for 10 minutes. It doesn't seem to be helping.
Yeah.
It's somewhat, but not really.
Yeah. Maliseb's a wonderful shampoo. It's one of the ones that I prescribe frequently, and our dermatology unit uses it as well. It's not only antibacterial but antifungal, so we use it a lot for bacterial infections and yeast infections. And sometimes when we have blackheads on the dog's back, we see this a lot in certain breeds, like Schnauzers get it a lot. They actually call it Schnauzer Comedone Syndrome. You never want to have a disease named, you know, after your dog, but any dog can have something like this happen. We always want to make sure that there isn't some underlying infection. So checking to see that the dog doesn't have a yeast infection or something like that on the back by doing some impression smears or skin scrapings, looking under the microscope. Typically, I will treat comedones or blackheads, if that's an issue, with something that's going to flush the pores a little bit more. And the shampoo I would be recommending is one that's a benzoyl peroxide shampoo. It can sometimes lighten the hair coat a little bit. You have to be careful. You don't want to use human products because dog skin's very different than human skin. But that might be something to talk to your veterinarian about and see if they have something like that on hand or whether you can get it via prescription online to just specifically wash that area, and it may help with getting some of those comedones cleaned out. But also be looking to make sure that your dog doesn't have any other underlying skin problem. Sometimes we will see dogs that have Cushing's disease or allergies run into sebum production problems and can have overproduction of oils and get blackheads too. So sometimes there's some underlying problems there that may need to be addressed as well without shampoo.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Teton in Black River Falls. Oh, we just lost that caller. Matt called to say his dog chews on plastic bottles, and it helps keep his teeth clean.
Yeah, a lot of dogs like chewing on the plastic water bottles, and they're soft enough that I think they're really pretty safe. And there's actually some toys that have a Velcro area that you can open up and insert a bottle so that instead of the squeaker losing its squeak, you just put a new water bottle in. And you have to be careful, though, with the rings and the cap, because those can pop off and the dog may eat them. So you might want to be careful with that.
We also had a listener call and ask when it's normal for a dog to start turning gray.
Oh, you know, there was a really interesting study that was just done in Colorado, and a couple of behaviorists and veterinarians. They went around to dog parks in Colorado and did surveys and took mugshots of dogs, and they ended up surveying about 400 dogs. And what they noticed is that people that ranked their dog as being a little more anxious or impulsive, maybe having some fear issues like noise phobias and things, grayed earlier, and they were more likely to have premature and graying. So, you know, the typical age that we'll see dogs start to gray is usually when they hit their senior years, like 9, 10. We'll start to see some graying then. When it's occurring as a younger dog, like 3 or 4, don't think that it's genetic. Start looking at, is there something in my dog's life that may be causing them to go gray a little bit earlier? So kind of like past President Barack Obama turning gray, you know, it's the same kind of thing, you know, after you get a little stressed and those gray hairs start popping out. So it was just a really interesting study, but I would not expect it until the dog becomes a senior.
Tony in Green Bay called to say his 11-year-old Afghan hound had been getting up about 5 times a night for the last 5 months. Seen the vet, has been on multiple medications and different food. Tony thinks this is a behavior problem, since sometimes the dog just goes outside and lies down.
Yeah, you know, and I'm glad that you took your dog to a veterinarian. I mean, this is an aged dog. Afghans are large breed dogs. We don't see them that often. We want to make sure that the dog isn't painful. Sometimes if they've got arthritis or something, when they're sleeping in one position, they may wake up and just get up and want to walk around because, things are hurting a little bit. We always want to make sure that there's nothing else medically going on, like are they having to get up and drink water, urinate, because sometimes things like kidney disease will cause a lot of nocturnal waking. And we also know that it can occur with dogs that have some cognitive decline, which is very common as dogs get older. And so we can see a change in their sleep-wake cycle, where they may be sleeping more during the day and up at night. And so sometimes it means us keeping them in, during the day a little more stimulated, having them go for getting better exercise, longer walks, more interactive play, so that they then sleep better at night. Sometimes we need to jump to using medical management to help them. I have many of my senior dogs on things like melatonin, a little Xanax or alprazolam to help them sleep. And there are other drugs that are specific drugs for treating dogs with cognitive decline. So it comes down to ruling out all the medical reasons and then, starting going down the path of let's treat this as if your dog has some senility issues and what can we do about it?
Wow. In the last 30 seconds, would you buy a King Charles or have a King Charles?
I would only do it if I knew the breeder and I knew what testing the breeder did. If they're doing eye testing, if I know that they've had their dogs in to be surf evaluated or heart evaluated and that their kneecaps are good, it would be a breed that I would consider, because I still see some that are coming in 11, 12, 13 years of age and going strong. Not that they don't have heart disease, but they can still be a very good dog. I love them. I think they're a wonderful dog. Yeah.
Dr. Sandy will be back on April 24th. She, of course, clinical instructor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Well, what have we got coming up tomorrow? Tomorrow at 11, we'll look at what's going on around the upper Mississippi River. And then at 11:45, we'll be talking about gourds, probably with the gourd gal. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store.